the first millennia to the second millennia. Now all historical distinctions of any kind that we suggest are arbitrary, because for our predecessors it was all divrei Elohim Chayim. Now it might be rich here or lacking there, but the distinctions that we suggest are not necessarily shared by our predecessors. If you would be asked, what is earlier, what is older, probably they wouldn't be sure. However, they were acquainted with the text. What they were acquainted with? They were acquainted with the halakhic literature, they were acquainted with Sefer Yetzirah, Book of Yetzirah, and they started to found the Kabbalah on the basis of this third book, on Sefer Avachim. Okay? We have three corpus: Heichalot literature, Sefer Yetzirah, and Sefer Avachim. Let us start by taking a glance on Heichalot literature that we spent the last two classes on, but I would like to say one more time what the major things about it. In order to understand Heichalot literature, we need to understand the fact that the temple has been destroyed. One cannot exaggerate in the traumatic importance of that point of departure. It is historical, it is mental, it's religious, it's sociological. If the temple would have not been destroyed, this literature would not have been created. Now, what's the meaning of this destruction of the temple? It's much more than only what we think about it. We know that for the Jews it has been a tragedy. However, we not always remember that for the Christians it was a moment of victory. And they were rubbing this wound time and again, because their contention was that the destruction of the temple for the Jews was the absolute sign that the covenant between God and the Jews has been broken. And now they are the new Israel. They are the new covenant. That's the reason that their book is called Brit Chadasha, the new covenant. But when they say that they are the new covenant, they claim that the Jews and their God have no covenant anymore. Now, of course, no Jew ever received that opinion, ever accepted that opinion. However, that opinion was the foundation of Christology. The idea that the whole entire biblical world, based on the covenant, on the holy law, on the chosen people, all of those things were contested by the Christians, who were gaining power century by century. It's not the first century that they were gaining power, it's the second and the third, while they were persecuted on one side, and soon enough, in the fourth century, they became to be the formal religion of Christians, of, you know, the Constantine conversion of the Byzantine Empire to Christianity. Ever since the mid of the 4th century, Christianity is the ruling religion of the ancient Roman Empire. Ever since, this is the religion of the ancient world and the new world. They are appropriating what was before the Hellenistic world, the Greek world, the Roman world. They made people to become Christians. Those who don't wish to become Christians are persecuted, punished, and the worst are the Jews, because the Jews are the incarnation of the earlier covenant. The Jews are the earlier believers of the Messiah, of the covenant, of God, of the law. The Christians are departing from all those covenants, claiming that they are the inheritors. Their main point of proof is the fact that the temple has been destroyed. And this is the proof that there is no more covenant, there is no more chosen people. All that, the foundations of biblical Israel, are profoundly contested by the Christians, by the Gnostics, by the Manichaeans. There is a whole lot of people who are contesting the foundation of the biblical position. Now that is the background to understand why we need various responses. Now the response that we know best is the response of the sages. The sages say we are continuing to live while making profound innovation, profound and innovation. The whole idea of oral law is a profound innovation, it's a profound adaptation, which is centered on this world. So the answer to the question is the very existence of us, our very devotion, belief, adaptation of the biblical law and all that, this is the foundation, this is the proof for our continued existence as people of God, as people of the covenant, even if reality is denying our contention. That is one way of claiming it. Another way, as I said, is the Karaim. The Karaim are claiming that the world as we know it should be frozen. Like we may not change anything. The Karaim are those who hold only to the biblical law, without any changes. They want to freeze the moment of the tragedy. They say, we are only holding to the biblical law. We are commemorating the tragedy of the destruction. We don't want to invent anything. We don't want to innovate anything. We don't want to adapt. We want to freeze the tragedy, to leave the tragedy, and to urge God on a daily basis to rectify the tragedy. So they claim by taking a very extreme position of living life of mourners, they would impose God to rectify the situation, to rebuild the temple, to reinvent biblical Israel, and so on.
There is a whole literature connecting this
Yes. Well, I don't feel that we have enough data to make connections. I think the disparity is too great historically. The Karaim are later in many centuries. To claim that they are direct continuation of Qumran, one has to substantiate it in a better way than it has been substantiated. Now that may not exclude the fact that they have been seeing themselves as continuing the biblical tradition as the Qumran people saw themselves. However, the Qumran people are not facing the result of the destruction of the temple. They are encountering a defiled temple that they hope to rectify, to reinstitute, to embellish, but they don't perceive the idea of broken temple, of destroyed temple. Nobody did. That was unthinkable. However, the whole question of the Karaim is a complicated one, and I don't wish to make any general conclusions, only to pay attention to the fact that they perceive themselves as the true Israel, as the only real keepers of this tradition, and as those that by keeping this tradition, by freezing it, would impose on God to return and rectify the destroyed temple.
Is there a parallel to the Karaim approach at immediately following the Qumran?
There are groups who are calling themselves Avelei Tzion, which later on would form as the Karaim. There is a definite response of people who are calling themselves Avelei Tzion, the more represent right after the Qumran. Yes.
Do we identify them?
No, not by name. We just know, we know it from the literature of the Christian passengers who are coming to follow Jesus, you know, the pilgrimage and all that. They are telling us that there are groups of Jews who are sitting in the bottom of the mountain and are mourning and are crying and are refusing to accept the new reality. There have been those, and they formed later on as the organized groups of the Karaim, Hanan ben David, Daniel el Kumari. That's a later thing, but the phenomenon of the mourners, those who refuse to accept the situation, is following directly the destruction. However, they might have been a marginal group. We don't know. I don't think they have been a central group. Only they pose the possibility of thinking that mourning and stopping living is a possibility. Now that did not become the central avenue. The central avenue was gained by the sages who were able to understand that only those who are able to change and adapt are having the upper hand in history. This is a rule. Only those who can adapt to changes are those who can encounter historical circumstances. They were able to offer new ideas, new avenues, new ways of exploration, and all of this, all this, the whole stuff, which is called Torah Shebe'al Peh, Chachamim, exploration, Midrash, Halakha, Agadah, the whole thing is the major avenue. But next to this major avenue, we should remember, there is the extreme option of Avelei Tzion, the mourners, those that don't wish to continue life. There is the new option of the mystics. The mystics who are those, the Heichalot literature people. Now what is their answer? As I said yesterday, they say, while we do not have an earthly temple, we have heavenly sanctuaries. And we are going to attest to that. We're going to testify. We have been there. Now who is we? We is Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Ishmael, Rabbi Nachunya ben Atana. And as I said, without making judgment, if those are the real Tanaim or if those are pseudo-epigraphical contentions about Tanaim, it doesn't make a difference. The thing which makes a difference is that a new spiritual option has been introduced, an active one. People are encouraged to pray with the angels, to ascend to the chariot, to descend to the chariot, and the minimum is to acknowledge the fact that an entirely new perception of heaven has been introduced, an entirely new perception of divine worship has been introduced. Now, let me accentuate the following. It is not replacement of the day-to-day work. The day-to-day worship is the same as it is always going on. The Torah, Mitzvot, and Halakha, and all that. That's the major avenue. But on top of it, not against it, not besides, on top of it, there is the spiritual option, which is called Heichalot, acknowledging temple, and acknowledging heaven as temple, in the plural form. Acknowledging the deity and sitting on the throne. Now, of course, for all of this, we have sources in Isaiah, in Ezekiel, in Micha. The Bible provides us the precedent for the idea that the deity is seated on a throne and is visible by the prophet from time to time. The throne, that is the chariot, the same thing, throne and chariot. As we know, like from Shmuel, that God is called Yoshev HaKruvim. HaKruvim are the chariots, the Kruvim is a throne, the Kruvim is the representation of the heavenly world, all of it. But the point for us is that now, this is not only an extreme moment of prophetic inspiration, such as Isaiah had, such as Ezekiel had. Now, this is a social compound that people are encouraged to participate in. As I said, when I said participate, they are asked to read. We said yesterday, Shomkeveh shomeh ta mishnah zot bechol yom vayom. You should read or recite or talk or hear this mishnah, which is referring to the new perception of the deity, to the new perception of heaven, to the ideas of the throne and the cherubim and the angels. A whole heavenly world has been created. The components are the chariot, the parvet, the divine name, the angels. All of that is part of a world which is constructing the invisible. I want to point it out again. They are constructing the invisible world by prayer, by divine revelation, by mystical ascent, and they are incorporating into that newly constructed heavenly picture the heritage of the Christian life. They are recruiting everything. They are getting the strong chariot visions from Qumran. They are getting the angelology from Qumran. They are taking Enoch from Qumran. They are recording everything with one exception. There is not a shred of polemic. They are not fighting against anybody. They are not charging anybody. There is no sense of light, sense of darkness. There is no good one better. The whole entire community is are to participate on various degrees. You can participate as reciting of the prayers. You are participating as listening to the descriptions of the heavenly world. They are offering an alternative. So the world as we know it, it's not only the day-to-day engagement of the mitzvot and halakha and all what the Jewish community is working around, but it is also another avenue to the invisible world, to the heavenly world. That much we can say for those chariot runners. Even if very few are engaged in practical mystical experience, and then we have details how to engage in this mystical experience. One is encouraged to sit in fast. One is told that if you fast 10 days or 12 days or 40 days, you would be able to transcend the borders of the existential world into the heavenly world. One is told that one should recite the heavenly names. We have numerous traditions on heavenly names. One is encouraged to recite the name of the angel. So the passage from this world to the heavenly world is through reciting names, reciting angelic descriptions, reciting angelic poetry. All together, it is called in one word, imitatio angelorum, in order to be one word. Imitatio angelorum, that means imitating the angel. Imitatio Dei is imitating God. Imitatio angelorum, all of that, the whole entire body of this literature is do like the angels do. Now that is definitely part of the command here, but it is devoid of any polemicism. It is new spiritual option. As I said, while different circles are telling the Jews, you have no temple, thus you have no more divine covenant. The mystics of the Heshalot say, we have 7 heavenly temples. We testify that we see God and we see the angels and we see the divine glamour and beauty. We glorify what we see. We incorporate it into our daily prayer, into our spiritual concern. For us, they say, this is a living religious experience. Whatever is happening on earth is devoid of meaning in comparison to what we can testify about. This foundation is taken from here to the next millennium. It is passing through different scripts. It is attested by the Geonim. In the 9th and 10th century, Sri Radaon and Hai Gaon are asked, Yelamdeinu Rabbeinu, Mahem Otam Mishnayot Elu Al Rabbi Akiva Ve Rabbi Ishmael. The Geonim are asked, please teach us, our masters, what are those Mishnayot that we are familiar with, which start with Amar Rabbi Akiva, Amar Rabbi Ishmael, which refer to, and they say the word, Pardes, Heichalot Rabati, Heichalot Dutati. In the volume of Baruch Levin, Osar HaGeonim LeChagiga, you can find the whole correspondence. The elders of Kairouan are sending correspondence to the Geonim in Babel, that's Iraq of today, and they're asking them, please advise us, what is the meaning of those things? And the Geonim are saying in a very beautiful way, those are religious engagements of people who are imagining in their mind the heavenly world. They are affirming it, they are consecrating it, they are considering it of high religious value. All the texts are in the Otsar HaGeonim LeChagiga, the portion of the answers. You know, it is divided to questions and answers. In Otsar HaGeonim LeChagiga, the portions of the answers, you can find it. It is referring to the section of Haggadah, Arba'ah Nichnasu LaPardes, and there is a really beautiful elaboration and extremely clever description of the whole thing. The Geonim approbation, or the Geonim haskamot on those parts in Mishnayot and literature, paved the way to the whole entire Jewish community. Those who were living according to the land of Israel traditions, those who were living according to the land of Babylon traditions, those who lived according to the Italian tradition, to incorporate this literature into their curriculum. Now, that was never one part of the major curriculum. It was the concern of those who saw themselves as Chacham Umedim in that story. We talked about him. Those who felt that they are interested, involved, committed, exploring spiritual possibilities were studying it and were teaching it. It was not part of the public discourse, it was part of the elitistic discourse. That's the way it was transmitted. Yes.
Do you have any testimony whether or not Pitya O'Neill themselves were actively involved in?
No, we don't have any such testimony whether they were involved, but we have testimony that they acknowledged it as a great religious literature, and they ascribed it to Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael of the Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael of the Mishnah. For them, those are the same, and they see no difference. Now, again, this is a late historical evidence, but this is the major tradition and was kept in the center of the religious world, which the legitimacy and authority of the Geonim was the major way to incorporate. Okay, we are reading that literature and we recall that it has various genres, various expressions, various books. There is a Chalot Rabati, Chalot Utarti, Merkaba Rabba, Merkaba Zuta, Sheur Koma, Shilchei Matatron, Chanoch HaShlishi. There are about 12 different books, not books, you know, booklets or texts or something, which are beautifully written, which are written tradition, and which are creating a new heavenly world or a new invisible world. Yes.
Was there any thought or literature on?
Was there any
published literature that predated the Korban?
No. Hey, Chalot literature is definitely after the Korban, and as I explained, maybe in a class that you will not hear, since the heroes are Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Ishmael, it cannot predate the Korban.
But there was no discussion of like a parallel Beit HaMikdash?
This particular literature of poetical nature, of mystical engagement, of angels and chariots and thrones in an active way, inviting people to participate, is definitely post-destruction literature. Okay? We want to leave that, and we want now to move to that literature. Now, Sefer Yetzirah, or the Book of Creation, is a very short text. Now, this is not literature. Please note the difference. This is literature, because there is a variety of texts here, and hello, literature. Sefer Yetzirah is actually, the word Sefer is rather an exaggeration. It's really about 5 pages, if I'll be very general. 3 pages. You can minimize the whole entire Sefer Yetzirah into 3-4 folio pages. Why is it called Sefer Yetzirah? For numerous reasons, but not because of its size, not because of its volume. Do you have this Sefer in front of you? No, it's not for a second. I want to
know.
Yes, that's exactly what I want to say. You see that? This is the text of Sefer Yetzirah. All that is commentary. That is exactly explained. Now, you see, all that is commentary. This is one line, okay? This is really very beautifully introduced here. Why? On those 3-4 pages, as I said, in very general counting, on those 3-4 pages, we have endless exposition. If for no other reason, that tells you how important it was. On Hechalot literature, we have numerous writings of Hasidei Ashkenaz. On every line of the Hechalot literature, we have like a Talmud around it of Hasidei Ashkenaz. However, it hasn't been published. It's all in manuscript. The Hechalot literature as a corpus was published like in its entirety or in its majority only in the end of the 20th century. When I published a critical edition of Hechalot Zutarti, a very preliminary critical edition, it was the first time that this text was ever published. I published it in 1982, And not because I felt sure enough that I'm able to do it, but because there was no way to discuss it without reading it. And since it was not available, you know, I made it available by publishing it, by commenting. Now, why I was supposed to be the first one? I mean, other texts could have been published before, but it is not a book form. It doesn't have a genre precedent. It doesn't look like other books. So people were afraid to publish it because they didn't know how to work it out. I think the other way around. The best way to consider a text is, first of all, make it available. Then we can correct, we can assess, we can analyze, we can compare. If it's in manuscripts, for most readers, it's beyond accessibility. What's nowadays available was not available 20 years ago. There was no such a thing as computerized system text and so on. And yes, this is very far from being a good edition, but this is available edition, so one can work with it. Peter Schaeffer took the other possibility. He took the, let's say, seven good manuscripts of Hecalot literature, and he arranged them one next to the other, one next to the other, with no comments, with no analysis, with no introduction, with no editorial work. He just sort of, if we would loan a metaphor, he was taking a snapshot of it, arranging it in an album, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, only he made it the favor of transcribing it in printed version rather than in scriptural version. So we had seven columns, one next to the other, of seven available manuscripts of Hecalot literature, and in that kind of reading, like reading it horizontally and synoptically, one can correct the failures of the different manuscripts just by comparing it. This is very good and very helpful, however, it is answering partial needs. It does not answer the other needs. Each one of those texts requires analytical presentation, editorial work, commenting, criticizing, and so on and so forth. Not all of them have it, some of them have it. Chanoch HaKadoshi has it, Hecalot Dikati has it, Shivchei Matatron doesn't have it, Hecalot Rabati doesn't have it. However, we do have here a whole literature that was working its way through manuscripts. Here we have a difference. Sefer Yetzirah, as I said, is a book of three pages. But on every three pages, we have hundreds of commentators. Now, who are the commentators? It says here, we have Perush Chachmoni. Chachmoni is Shabtai Donolo from 9th century Italy. Perush HaRaavat, Rabbi Abraham ben David, that's Abraham ben David from Poitiers, from France, in the 12th century. That's Narbonne and Poitiers, the center of the yeshivot in France. Ramban, 12th century, 13th century, Spain, Barcelona. Perush Rav Seavia Gaon, 9th, 10th century, Egypt, that's Geonim. Eliezer Nivo Maida, each one of them is offering is Perush on Sefer Yetzirah. Eliezer Nivo Maida is Chassidei Ashkenaz, 12th century, Germany. Moshe Rabbi Yaakov, Baal Sefer Otsar Shushan Todot, that's a guy who was living in Russia, in Krim, in the 12th century. So this book, and this is only part, there is Moshe Butari, there is Yitzchak Isaac, there is the Ari, there are numerous commentators on those few pages. What does that tell us? That those three, four pages were enigmatic enough to require endless interpretation, to accommodate different integrations of those sentences into the new world of thought. Okay, short comment.
Can you talk about the commentators in Sefer Hecalot? Who were they?
Chassidei Ashkenaz. The comments, Chassidei Ashkenaz, like Eliezer Mivar Maiza, Yehuda Chassid, the family of Yehuda Chassid, the students of Rabbi Elazar, the circle which is called Chassidei Ashkenaz.
Who had the manuscripts?
Chassidei Ashkenaz. All those manuscripts. Where are they?
Yeah.
Many of them are in Germany, some of them in Budapest, some of them in Roxy College, they're all over the world. But their photocopies, all their photocopies are in the National Library in Jerusalem and presumably here in the JCS or in one of the libraries in the
field.
Yes, it is. It has been published now. It has been published in the 20th century. It hasn't been published before because of the fact that it's not part of a genre. It doesn't look like something that you know how to handle. It's portions, it's songs. It's like we read yesterday. People were afraid. No, the Tolkien work. Some of the Tolkien were published, yes, like Todei Razaya, Digrei Rabbi Elazar, yeah. The Tolkien were published, the texts were not published. Okay, we want to proceed to Sefer Yetzirah. As I said, it has been incorporated into the life of intellectual circles of various kinds and various places. If we have commentaries of the Geonim, of Reshit HaKabbalah, of Ashkenazi Hasidim, it has been studied, it has been analyzed all over the Jewish globe. It was considered to be of holiness and of importance. How does it start? Let us see. Very hard to find the text here after all the Akdamot. The Mishnah Rishonah I know by heart, you should know it too. ב-32 נתיבות קליעות חוכמה חתך אדוני צבאות אלוהי ישראל אלוהים חיים ומלך העולם אל שדי רחום וחנון רם ונישא שוכן עד מרום וקדוש שמו וברא את עולמו בשלושה ספרים בספר, ספר וסיפור. That sentence you must say. God created the world in three Sefer, Sefer, Vesikur. Sefer, the text that we have it is, now this is very beautiful, this is very beautiful book in Hebrew, because you can introduce from this book numerous things. In some of the manuscripts, instead of having Sefer, Sefer, Vesikur, we have Sefer, Mishpat, the Sipur, which I assume is the origin of the manuscript. That's the way it should be. Because what they want to tell us is that the creation took place in a different way than what we know. The usual story of creation is the story of Genesis. We are told that God created the world in a course of 6 weeks, and we were not there, we were not participating, we don't know anything about that. Okay, I'll return. However, you wanted to comment?
I'm not reading this paper, so
carefully. Well, you can read it, as I said, not Agulapi, Agnon. Okay, Agnon reads it as Feser Sofer Vesikur. I suggest to read it Feser Mispar Vesikur. Other reading, Sefer Mesoper Vesikur. All of them together, regardless to the question how was it really written, as I said, in the manuscripts we have various possibilities, all of them are referring to all the possibilities of the beautiful book, Sefer Mesoper or Mispar Vesikur. Now what is it? There is a book there in the process of creation. There is a narrative, there is a number, there is a clock, there is an account, there is a recount. All those things are entirely new. Why? They add the one component that humans and divine are sharing, and nobody else. They add letters and numbers to the process of creation. No animal and no nature, no part of nature, is sharing the greatness of the language, the literature, the book, the narrative, the letters, the numbers. All of that ingenious addition is the story of the creation. Now one can definitely deduce it from the very story of creation of Genesis. As we know, there are Asara Ma'amarot, God is saying, let there be light, and there is light. So the light is not created by silence, it is created by speech. the water are not created by absence, they are created by speech which is present. Now that is of great importance, because when we understand that the great step of Sefer Yetzirah is adding language to nature, all the whole entire mythology of creation of all religions of all cultures are not introducing the idea that speech and language, letters and numbers, are part of creation. Here in this book, we are told that the process of creation is Shebara et olamo b'shlosha tfarim b'seter v'seter v'sipur or b'seter mitzvah v'sipur or b'seter soper mitzvah. Now this tfarim, if we are told that God created the world by three books, we are also encouraged to participate in understanding what are those three books. Where are we in relation to those three books? Whatever those books are, but it is part of our engagement. We are also participating in reading, writing, creating, composing, deleting the very speech that is a creative process is shared by the divine and the human. Now of course it's not going to equal between them, but the possibility is there. The idea that speech is divine and creative, the idea that speech is endless, the idea that the divine speech is creative and the human speech, with all due respect for difference, is also creation, is also infinite. Now the great thing of Sefer Yetzirah is the continuation of that. As I said, in every two lines there are seven pages of okay. Eser Sfirot Blima. This is the second sentence. This is the foundation of all Jewish mysticism. Eser Sfirot Blima. Ve'esrim v'shtayim otiyot yesod. Shalosh imot v'sheva kfulot v'shtem esrat kfulot. I'll translate. As you recall, the first Mishnah says, parts that by 32 packets of wisdom, God created the world. The question is, what is that 32 numbers? Where is that coming from? The answer is, it's constituted of Eser Sfirot Blima. Eser Sfirot Blima. Ve'esrim v'shtayim otiyot yesod. 22 letters that we know what are they. Those are the 22 letters of our alphabet. And Eser Sfirot Blima. Now this is a beautiful enigmatic sentence. For that sentence, no more interpretations have been written. What is Eser Sfirot Blima? How should one translate it? Probably, presumably, the immediate translation of it is just those are 10 digits, infinite digits. Digits as letters. The components of this beautiful Mishnah, this sentence, is that the 32 passages of wisdom through which God Almighty created the world are constituted from 22 letters and 10 numbers. Numbers, as you know, in Hebrew, the Shoresh Samech Peiresh is referring to mitzvah, to number, to sfirah, which is counting. Letters are, what's the word letter? Ot. Yes? Now, in many of the perushim of Sefer Yetzirah, we are told that Ot is from the root Aleph Taf Aleph, like Ye'eteh Ve'yavo, which means ever coming. Ata Boker Uvalaya, like in Chayah. It is ever coming. The letters are no commodity that you can waste or finish. It is an ever rich commodity. I'm sorry? Well, it is in the Bible. Yes, Ata Boker Uvalaya. It is in number of places. Yeah, Aleph Tav Aleph es lavo, es coming, es ever coming. Ye ester ve yavo, ata boker uvalayim. Iti mi Lebanon, like boy mi Lebanon, iti mi Lebanon. The word ot is from Aleph Tav Aleph ye ester ve yavo. The idea here is that the letters are always coming. You cannot waste them. You cannot overuse them. You cannot say, if you would use those letters, you would finish them, or you would do without them. The letters are infinite. The only infinite thing that we have is this infinite letters and infinite numbers. That's the idea of Sefer. I didn't come yet to Blima. I didn't say anything yet on Blima. I'm still on just the very basis of Sefer Yetzirah, because that is such a great book. It is, we are told that the process of creation is by the infinite letters and the infinite numbers, which are ascribed here divine origin. That hasn't been told before. The fact that 10 Sfirot Blima ו-22 Otiyot Yesod, that's the foundation of all creation. I want you to reflect a moment on the greatness of this cosmos. This is the one thing that nobody can say, I possess, it belongs to me. No one can say, the language is my own property. No one can say, the numbers are only mine and not yours. I will not lend you, I will not take you. You cannot possess numbers or letters. You cannot take it, you cannot possess it, you cannot exclude it. You may do all kinds of bad things to their results, but you cannot possess or take letters and numbers. This is the constant of the human spirit, and we are told that those are the constant of the divine creative spirit. We are encouraged to share the creative power of letters and numbers with the divine source of its foundation. It's the process of creation through language and through numbers, which is attested here in Sefer Yetzirah, and which immediately is shared by humans. Because the definition of human being, unlike any other natural being, is that the being that shares the capacity of using letters and numbers by various degrees, by speaking, by talking, by reading, by writing, by calculating, by accounting, by miscalculating and misexpressing. But this is also done by letters and by numbers. We are told that the divine components of creation are also shared by humans. This is an entire innovation. Now note that we have no idea who wrote Sefer Yetzirah. We don't know when it was written. Yehuda Leibowitz claimed that it was written in the 1st century. Nehemiah Aloni claimed that it was written in the 8th century. Numerous scholars ascribe it to a different century. All of them agree that it was written in the century of the first millennium. I say it doesn't really matter when it was written. Matters one thing. It made enormous impression on Jewish thinking. It's a new avenue of thought on Jewish thinking. From this stage on, the interpretations are what creates Kabbalah. In order to have Kabbalah in the second millennium, we must have those three components. We must have Sefer Yetzirah, we must have Sefer Habayir, and we must have Heichalot. In a way, if you want to imagine it, this is the origin into which those three rivers are fitting. The river of the Heichalot, the priestly mystical avenue, the river of the Sefer Yetzirah, the unknown unicum, we don't know who wrote it and where and why, and all speculations are, with all due respect, yet there is no final conclusion. We do have the text. And the Sefer Habayir that we approach them. But let us see what this word Blima. Maybe that's the word which starts Kabbalah. What is Blima? Presumably, by the first author, it was something it's meant to say, like Tole Eretz al Blima, in Sefer Yetzirah. What's Tole Eretz al Blima? The land or the universe is hanged on, we don't know what, on an edge. on the unconceivable, on the unperceivable. We don't know exactly, but this word has another fantastic meaning. How do we use it today?
Break.
Live long, but Balami, that's the word break. What is break? To hold, right? Because what is exactly it is searching? It is what later on we would call Hitzpashtut Metzimtzum. The numbers are infinite, but they are also finite. The letters are infinite, but they are also finite. Most likely, the idea of Otiyot Yesod and Sirot Blima is that dialectical idea of the infinite and the whole, or the finite. Think about it for a second in this way. We have only 10 digits, no more, think of them, we have from 1 to 10. From those 10 digits, all numbers are composed. All numbers, to endless and endless and endless. Simply this way. Let's say that all the numbers are springing out from a source, like a well of numbers. Let's think that all the letters are like this and like that. The chains of letters are springing from the divinity. However, in order to create something out of those letters, what do we have to do? We have to stop it. We have to cut it. We have to give it a form. Kol bri'ah hidin. Every creation is a border, is a line, is a distinction. Because if I say, look, all the letters are in the dictionary, but what are words? Word is a whole, a blima, a distinction of the endless letters. We have a dialectical circle. All the letters available in the Hebrew language are 22. All the numbers available are 10. From the 10 finite numbers, we have infinite creative force. From the 22 final letters, we have endless amount of words. But in order to make a word out of the letters, or to make a formula out of the numbers, we have to do blima. So we have here the whole thought of Sefer Yetzirah is the dialectic between Hitpashtut veTzimtzum, the overflow and the restriction. The bri'ah, the Hitpashtut ha'tzala on one side and blima on the other side. The ever abundant and affluent of letters and numbers. Remember, by nature they are infinite. They don't belong to anyone. That's the spirit. And yet the other element is the blima, is the stopping, is the holding, live long. Okay? So, we have that principle, which is the foundation of the Kabbalistic mysticism. That would be explored and reworked and sought and interpreted in a course of a millennium. And another millennium. The whole entire Kabbalistic thought is based on the idea of the 10 spheres. They start as 10 numbers, only 10 numbers from 1 to 10. But then, through exploration, we are told that those numbers are not only like 1 to 3 as we know, but they are also like numerical abstractions in space, in the invisible space. The letters are not only letters as we use them, but they are runs in the invisible place. But those 10 spheres are the runs of the invisible space. I repeat, it starts only by the very plain idea of being numbers as components of creation. But through the speculative thinking, numbers become to be a run, a sphere, a space, a distinction of space. And in Sefer HaBahir, those ones or those numbers are becoming to be attributes. They are part of the divine attribute. So we have here a process. We start by letters and numbers. It's so easy to understand because we all know what are letters and what are numbers. But those letters and numbers, which have infinite creative power, an endless source of, and preconditions by this topic, by the Blima, are turning to be, in the course of the speculative way of thinking, they are turning to be into sphere. So if you wish, if we would draw it, it would be, let's say that this is one and this is two and this is three. One is turned to be like that, two is turned to be like that, three is turned to be like that, and the relations between those numbers, which turns to be into spheres and into rounds and into dimensions. That's what later on would constitute the invisible world of the design. I want you to know the difference between what was going on here and what is going on here. All the divisions of this heavenly functioning are in relation to the temple in one way or another. They are called sanctuary, they are thrones, they are chariots, all this stuff of the priestly angelological perception of the home. They have nothing to do with letters and numbers. Over here, that has nothing to do with sanctuary and angels and angels. Those are abstractions of letters and numbers. Second Yetzira is not about commemoration. It's not about compensation. It's not about alternatives for destroyed temple. It doesn't know anything about it. Because of this, it would deliver claiming that it was written in the first century of the Common Era, because it's impossible that anything would be written after the destruction and would be so harmonious and so systematic or serene or something like that. Now, as I said, it is an interesting suggestion, but it's not beyond speculative assertion. What we do know is that the second Mishnah, I call each sentence of those contentions of Sefer Yetzirah, start Mishnah Aleph, Mishnah Bet. The second Mishnah is Eter Tzirot Blima, between the time of Yot Yisod, and now we are coming to this next stage, entirely new, never heard before. We are told that those 22 letters that we are all familiar with of the Hebrew alphabet are divided to Shalosh Imo, Sheva Kfulot, the 12 Pshutot. 12 ve'od Sheva ve'od Shalosh is 22. The author of Sefer Yetzirah is telling us that grammar is a constituency of the heavenly world. The heavenly world is creating through letters and through numbers, but acknowledging the inner distinctions of letters and numbers. We start by the distinctions of letters. We have 22 letters. What are Shalosh Imot? S. Otiyot S. What are Sheva Kfulot? What we call Dagesh. I'm sure that in your course of Hebrew studies, you know about Otiyot Gushot and Otiyot Kalot. Beget Kefet, Bet Gimal Kaf Pei Tav, Beget Kefet, and you don't know it? Okay. I'm sorry. Yeah, but just a second. Beget Kefet is what nowadays we are referring to Otiyot Mekablot Dagesh, Otiyot Shesalagi. Bet the bet, pay the pay. In this literature, there is another letter, rage, like raza, raza, raza. That's the rage busha. Nowadays we know it, but in the Arabic, in the Semitic languages, rage, like, you know that the Arabs say raza, in English we say gaza, in Hebrew we say azza. It's all the same letter when it is double R, ran. Yeah? Okay. The other letters, which are not imot, which are not aleph, mem, and shin, are otiyot pshutot. The others, which are not dagesh and which are not foundation letters, are well said. Now, why do we need that distinction? Because Sefer Yetzirah is about to create a cosmic order which everything corresponds to everything. This new cosmic order has nothing to do with history, has nothing to do with priests, has nothing to do with angels, has nothing to do with sanctuary. It has to do with the universal law of language. How does it go afterwards? After it says that it's dividing, it says, Ezer Sirot Blima. Now we're going to the numbers. 10 numbers, Ezer Sirot Blima, Mitzar Ezer Etzbaot. The 10 numbers that we're speaking about are like the 10 fingers. Chamesh keneged chamesh, וברית מאור וברית יחיד מכוונת באמצע כמילת הלשון וכמילת המאור. It tries to make a constitution of the world. Five and five. In the middle of these five, there is something which he calls ברית לשון and ברית מאור. ברית יחוד, ברית מאור, ברית לשון. There is something in the order of the numbers which has a structure in the middle of which there is a covenant of two kinds. A covenant that refers to the mouth, that's Brit HaLashon, everything that we do with letters and numbers, that's Brit HaLashon. The second one is Brit HaMa'or, that's everything which refers to co-creation, eternity, creativity. This word Ma'or then forms the root of Erva, Arayot, Irim, Arayot, that refers to the reproductive order. It has the vision of numbers on one side, number on the other side, and two covenants. One is the covenant of the spirit, one is the covenant of the body. The covenant of the eternal spirit through letters and numbers. The creative power of the human spirit and the divine spirit through letters and numbers. And the covenant of the eternal project through the Ma'o. Ma'o, that's the reproductive order that assures continuity and creativity. I'm sorry? Yes. It is, but here it is not only Komakada. It's the whole entire world is divided as numbers and letters and human form. Adam Olam Katan. Yes, Adam Olam Katan is like from here. Okay, the next sentence: Eter Sirot Blima, Eter Velo Tesha, Eter Velo Achat. We are speaking on those 10 digits. No more. We are not speaking on 11, we are not speaking on 12, we are not speaking on 4. We are speaking on Eter Sirot Blima, Eter Velo Tesha, Eter Velo Achat. So because of that, it said in the previous sentence, it's like the fingers of your hand, 5 and 5. No more. Later on, the Kabbalists would say there are 10 spheres. No more. You cannot say there are 11 spheres. You cannot say there are 9 spheres. It is the 10 spheres which are attested in Sefer Yetzirah. It goes on and on like that. Alan, you wanted to say?
Yes.
There are numerous explanations why the earth is like that. Some said it's about Avir Mayim Esh, the foundations of. Later on, he would offer different systematic distinctions. But he needs, for the whole cosmic system, three different things. Three. One kind of letter, 7 another kind of letter, and 12 another kind. Because later, we would have the distinctions of 3, 7, and 12 for the whole entire cosmic structure. Okay? That makes those distinctions. Yes.
They're still in communication with the priestly. Those 7 and 12 are very distinct priestly.
The 7 and 12 for priestly, the 3 is not necessarily.
Right, although 3 show, I think all 3 words.
Might be. However, it is not introduced here under that framework. It is introduced here, as you can follow, entirely cosmic, broad, grammatical. It's not geographical. It's not referring to any particular place, and yet not even to any particular people. It refers to a particular language. It's the language that has 22 letters, the Hebrew language, and the numbers that have 10 digits according to this system, and not others. that it's important for it to be universal and not local. It's the whole entire universal order that it is trying to introduce. Now here comes the first instruction or the first conclusion for the human. It starts Eser Sfirot Blima, Eser Velo Teisha, Eser Velo Achatzeh, 10 spheres of Blima, Eser, 10 and not 9, 10 and not 9. And here is the instruction. Haven bechokma, vechacham bebina, bechon bahem, vechako mehem, vehaamed davar al buryo, vehashev yoter al mechona. We were never told that sentence earlier. Here the human being is encouraged, is even commanded, to be an intellectual partner to the creative process. We are told that on the basis of this foundation, the 10 numbers and the 22 letters, everyone is encouraged, haven bechokma, be wise with wisdom, chacham bebina, have insight and thoughtfulness, bechan bahem, look into them. Chakor mehem, research them. Ha'amed davar al buryo, institute everything on its foundation. Ve'hashev yoter al nechono. That's so interesting. Hashev yoter al nechono is, and you, it's up to you to seek or to institute the creator in its center. It is you, the human being, who is Hashem Yotzer al Nechono. Hashem is like the command of Lashev. Lashev is to sit. Hashem is you should sit. Usually we don't really use this form very often, but Lehoshiv Mishu is to sit. Hashem Yotzer al Nechono, you should sit the Creator in Machon. Machon is one of the words in the Bible for the heavenly sanctuary. Machon Olamim, I don't remember where it is, but Machon and Ma'on and Da. Machon is the Olamim, yeah. That's the place where. Anyhow, Hashem Yotzer al Nechono. Now that, which until now could have been only general, universal, scientific perception, is turned by this message into a religious command. It's upon you, the human, to explore, to understand, to analyze, to employ insight. By that process, by that intellectual process, you are constituting or befitting the Creator in its heavenly sanctuary. That's quite a demand. Now here's the next thing, and that's where the numbers are turning into spiritual or intellectual or universal dimension further than numerical level. Mishnah says, Eser Sfirot Blima, Midatan Eser She'en Lahem Sof. What a beautiful sentence. Eser Sfirot Blima, 10 spheres of nothingness, 10 spheres of holding, Midatan Eser She'en Lahem Sof. Its measures are 10. But they are infinite. They are numbered by 10, but they are infinite. That's what I said before. Midatan Eser. There are 10 spheres of whatever kind, but they are infinite. So in the deity, that's the nature of the deity. It's the infinite and the finite. The dialectical. Those 10 digits, numbers, spheres, Midatan Eser. The division within the deity is 10. It's 10 fold division. But this tenfold division is infinite as the numbers. The numbers are infinite. No one can say that's the end of the numbers, because on any number you would say, you can say plus one, plus two, plus three. Here it says, Eser Sfirot Blima, Midatan Eser. They are counted by 10, they're measured by 10, She'en Lahem Sof, that they have no finite, there is no entry. What are those 10 rounds? What are those 10 spheres? I'll read it in Hebrew and then I'll translate. Omek Reshit ve'omek Acharit. Omek Tov ve'omek Ra. Omek Rom ve'omek Tachat. Omek Mizrach ve'omek Ma'arav. Omek Tzafon ve'omek Darom. Adon Yachid El Melech Ne'eman Moshel Bechulam Mineon Kodesho ve'ad Adei. that's a new perception of the divine world, of the human world. The 10 wants are now presented as 10 depths. The word omek is depth. What are those 10 depths? Those are the 10 measures which are infinite. Omek Rashid, the depth of the beginning. Who knows where beginning began? The depth of the beginning. Omek Achalit, the depth of the end. Omek Tov. Yeah, Reshit and Acharit is the beginning of time and space. Reshit and Acharit is the very beginning, and beginning is always in time and in space. If there is beginning in time, there is beginning in space. There is no time without space, there is no space without time. Omek Reshit is the beginning of time and space. The Omek Acharit, the death of the end in time and space. Omek Tov, the depth of the good, the Omek Ra, the depth of evil. Please note how the cosmic is adjacent to the moral. The depth of the beginning and the depth of the end, the depth of good and the depth of evil. Omek Rom, the Omek Tach, the depth of the high, the depth of the beneath. I don't know what would be the right what's under us. The depth of the underdog, the depth of the below. Omek Mizra, the depth of the east, the Omek Ma'arav, the depth of the west. Omek Safon, the Omek Darom, the depth of the north, the depth of the south. And on all those 10 depths of space and time and good and evil, Adon Yachid El Melech Ne'eman. One master, one king, one devoted king, Moshel Bekulam. Adon Yachid El Melech Ne'eman, Moshel Bekulam, Mine'on Kodesho. God Almighty, the one master, is ruling all of them from Ma'on Kodesho, from the sacred dwelling, Ve'ad Adel Ad, forever and ever and ever. This is certainly extraordinary language. This is certainly not a biblical language. This is certainly something new. Mishnah Vav, Eser Sfirot Blima, Fiyatan Kemarei Agaza, Vetachlitan En Lahem Ket. Vedvaro Bahem Berasto Vasho, Ulemamaro Kesufa Erdofu, Velifnei Kiso En Mishtachav. Those 10 spheres of endlessness, Fiyatan Kemarei Agaza. Where is this verb coming from? From Yechezkel. Fiyatan kemar'ei habazak. Yechezkel, when Yechezkel was seeing the divine vision of the throne, the divine vision of the chariot, he's describing it as visible and invisible. A moment of sight and stopping of that. Fiyatan kemar'ei habazak. Now another thing here is Sofei Merkava. The people who wrote the Heichalot literature define themselves as the viewers of the chariot, those who are looking, peeping, observing, glancing at the divine chariot. Here we are told, Eter Sfirot Blima, Siyatan Kemar'ei Habazak. You can see them as a vision of lightning. Bazak is usually like barak, like lightning. Vetachlitan en lahem ket. They are endless. There is no end to them. No one, no human can say, I've seen it all, because it is infinite. It's really resembled to our perception nowadays of the cosmos. Like we know, we acknowledge the fact that whatever we see on the cosmic globe, it's only the tiny edge of the infinite that we don't see. Fiyatan kemar'ei habazak, vetachlitan en lahem ket. Udvaro bahem beratzo vashon. And the divine word in is beratzo vashon, which is of course Yechezkel. What does Yechezkel say, beratzo vashon? V'hachayot ratzo vashon. And the holy beings are two and four. Ratzo vashon. Like this and like that. Like this and like that. Forward and backward. Beratzo vashon. Ulema amaro ketsufayadu. To the divine utterance, they are following like four places are like a sword. All those ten dimensions, all those ten infinite measures, all of them are bowing in front of the chariot throne. Eser sfirot bima, sofam na'ut sofam betfilatam, ותחילתם בסופם כשלהבת קשורה בגחלת, שאדון יחיד ואין לו שני, ולפני אחד מה אתה סופר. Ten spheres of nothingness, their beginning is tied into their end, and their end is in their beginning, כשלהבת קשורה בגחלת, like a fire in a coal, שאדון יחיד ואין לו שני, that one master who has no second, ולפני אחד מה אתה סופר. How can you count before one? It goes on, but I would not read more. You would read it all. Each one of you has to read the whole three pages of Sefer Yetzirah in Hebrew or in English, and to get acquainted with the beauty, with the rhyme, with the new world which is continuing there. What is this new world? It's a new perception of the invisible. It's a new perception of the deity. It's a new perception of the cosmos. It's entirely new world. What does that world demand from us? We are told to conclude that section, this is Mishnachet, Eser Sfirot Blima, Blom Ticha Miledaber, Velibcha Mileaher, ואם רק לבך שוב למקום, שלכך נאמר והחיות רצו לשוב, והדבר הזה נחרט הכי. To remember that that resembles to the verse that we read yesterday. עשר ספירות בלימה, the ten spheres of nothingness, בלום פיך מלדבר, shut your mouth, that's the attest that they know exactly that בלום and בלימה are coming from the same place, בלום פיך מלדבר, shut your mouth, don't speak about it. בלום פיך מלדבר ולבך מלהעבר. Stop your heart from contemplating. ואם רק לבך שוב למקום, if your heart was running, return it to its place. שלכך נאמר והחיות רצו לשוב. On them it has been told that the holy creatures are running to and from. ועל דבר זה נקרא הבא. The association with Yechezkel are very obvious. The dialectic of running up and coming down is very obvious. The whole role of humans is entirely new. The whole perception of the deity is entirely new. The combination of it is entirely new. The book proceeds by telling us what is the structure of the world. What are the three foundations, the fire, the water, the air? What are the 12 divisions, the 12 stars, the 12 portions of the zodiac, the 12 tribes, the 12 limbs? What are the seven? They would find connections between all the seven folds from the priestly heritage and the biblical heritage, all the 12 folds from the biblical heritage. It would work all the different details into one cosmic shape. Lives are turning into a contemplative, into a contemplative engagement on new foundation. Now you're supposed to contemplate. Da, hashov, so, bechon. Those things are know, think, explore, have insight, ponder, look into. The intellectual process of looking around, of finding the different components of the great chain of being, according to the rules that are introduced here, is what Sefer Yetzirah was doing. The whole entire Kabbalistic literature is based on these small segments, which each one of them is very rich. The way that I interpreted it now is one way of interpreting. All the numerous commentators and interpreters offered other interpretations, different readings. Now, those different readings were not exclusive or mutually exclusive. They were adding layer and layer and layer on layer. All of them were forming the new Kabbalistic literature. So when we ask, where Kabbalah started, the answer is, Kabbalah there is the ocean, there's the intellectual speculation on the hidden world, divided to 10 spheres, divided to ever-coming letters, to ever-coming numbers, to the dialectics of affluence or abundance and closure, is what knowledge, the Kabbalistic thing. Okay, now we have to take a look on the third book, on Sefer Abrahim. Yes.
I would have non-Jewish
input. I'm sorry.
Are there any non-Jewish inputs on the
here? Not that I can say positively. Others would say that it might be influenced from Pythagorean thinking. As I said, it might be. However, from the very moment that it has been written down in Hebrew, it has been introduced in a very holy way, like start by God Almighty and so on. As it is introduced as the process of the divine creation and the demand of human participation, whether it is Pythagoreic or whether it is Egyptian or whether it is Greek, it doesn't really matter, because its holiness is not derived from any external source. Its holiness is derived from the way it's presented. Now, at the end of the book, we are told that it was written by Abraham Avinu. It was not. However, the framework of writing is, as you see, it's not ascribed to any particular human being. However, Abraham is introduced as the person who was able to do those verbs, Bechan, Lechakor, Vedav, so the active intellectual engagement on the secret of creation. And for that, it is very true to introduce Abraham as the first person who is involved in that, because according to the Jewish history, Abraham is the first person who is aware of the connection between the transcendent divine world and the world of the senses as we see. In a way, that's what Sefer Yetzirah is trying to introduce. Abraham is the correspondent hero in the human realm that is expressing this apprehension, this deep connection between the divine power, the divine language, and the creation as we know and understand. As I said, Sefer Yetzirah was the subject of endless, numerous interpretations. What we have here in this edition is only a portion, a small portion of the endless interpretation. Every Kabbalistic writer interpreted it. Every Hasidic writer interpreted it. Every Rishnagic writer interpreted it. We have interpretation of it from the Gaon Mivilna, from Abshata Likosnis, and we have from Ha'ari, and we have from Kodovel. Everyone interpreted it. People studied it, thought about it, integrated into the language. From now on, the word Eser Sirot Blima, 10 spheres of nothingness, 10 spheres of dialectic meaning, is part of the Jewish language, which would develop to various directions. Now,
is this the first time we find in Jewish mysticism and even an attempt to describe the deity itself?
To describe?
The deity itself.
Well, I think that since we don't know the exact date of when it was written, we can't say if it's different. What we can say that this is entirely original way of thinking. It is beyond what we know on the biblical heritage. It's beyond what we know from Qumran literature. It's beyond what we know from the Mishnah. It is something new. It is something different. However, it is not against anybody. It's not polemicizing with anybody. It is, let's say, exploring a deeper meaning of the question, what creation is. What is the relation between divine and human? What is the nature of divine service that one is required to apply as a result of those notions? The idea of da and bechon, bechatzor, bechashor, bechakof, all those active verbs of speculations are introduced in addition to the common perception of the commandments. We are now asked to be engaged in speculative thinking on the nature of the deity, on the nature of the ten spheres, on the nature of the world as we know it, in relation to those invisible structures. This is new. That hasn't been before.
Just to follow up, the notion of intellectual
against anything or against anybody or in relation to anything or to anybody, because the book itself does not suggest. It does not mention any name of any historical being other than Abraham. It does not introduce itself in relation to rabbinic, post-rabbinic priestly or anything in a direct way. It suggests the truth of universal nature of religious commanding way of thinking. I don't think it's against anything. As I said, I think it's another layer of religious thinking and exploration. We are not told anywhere, and that's the sign of it, we are not told anywhere that there is any dispute about the veracity and importance of it. Now, when we have any kind of dispute, even the slightest, immediately we know that there is a tension between someone and there is not a word of dispute against Sefer Yetzirah in the whole entire body of Jewish.
I'm
sorry?
That
he does not agree with the author? No. No. Tadia Gaon made a wonderful commentator on Sefer Yetzirah. Well, that's not criticism. Saadia Gaon considered that to be a text of great importance. He is interpreting it according to his new position, which is in fact influenced by the Kalam, by the Arabic philosophy, but he's trying to adjust the two bodies of knowledge of the Arabic philosophy and Sefer Yetzirah. That's one way of doing it. Others would do it in an entirely Kabbalistic way, on a mystical way, on a philosophical way. This is not criticism. This is incorporation into the culture.
Does he specifically say that he doesn't agree with certain things?
I don't recall any particular thing that he disagree. I don't remember any notion. If you'll find one, show us. But I think that in general, the fact that it has been interpreted by Shabtai Zanolo in Italy, by Saadia Gaon in Mitzrayim, in Fayum, by Rabat in France, by the entire body of Kabbalistic authors, tells us that the book was incorporated into Jewish thinking with great power. One can notice that it adds a whole new layer of thinking, of lingual innovation, which hasn't been there before.
If he does,
I don't recall. If he does anything particularly on Sefer Yetzirah, I don't remember. I don't have a recollection of any particular thing of the Rambam. I have a recollection of what he says about portions of the Pesukei Halot in a negative way. On Shiur Komadi disagree, but I don't recall anything of Sefer Yetzirah. But one can look into that and find out. Yes.
You mentioned the first of the Pirushim seems to be in the latter part of the first millennium.
Yes.
But the authorities you mentioned speculating on when it was written seem to put it much earlier.
Yes, as I said. Sefer Yetzirah is mentioned in the Talmud. Sefer Yetzirah is mentioned in the Talmud. So it could not be later than the Talmudic period. However, the whole notion of writing interpretation of a book, this is an innovation that hasn't been introduced before the 8th, 9th century. That's part of what we know as the Hafradat HaMikso'ot, the specialization of different intellectual engagements. In earlier periods, we were not familiar with distinctions between different professions, intellectual professions. The idea of commentary is fairly late. It's not a new thing. It's not a midrash, it's a commentary. So the commentators are naturally post the Islamic period, because before the Islamic period, we didn't have the notion of commentary. So it doesn't bear any evidence on the time that the book was authored. It only bears evidence on the time that the book has been part of the commentary work. So, as I said, when we talk on the time that this book could have been authored, it is between the 1st century of the Common Era to the 5th century, 4th century of the Common Era. Since it is mentioned in the Talmud, it's before 500. Okay.
But that sentence,
Chakor v'Haven,
isn't that a reflection of the Bible?
Everything is a reflection of the Bible. You see, everything, one can say, we can say that everything in one way or another is a reflection of the Bible. However, it's not quoting the Bible verse by verse, it is reworking the biblical thought in new elements. The fact that it brings Ezekiel, it certainly brings Ezekiel. Well, it is certainly informed by Hebrew. Hebrew is a biblical language in that state. Hebrew and Bible are definitely the nourishment of Sefer Yetzirah. But Sefer Yetzirah is not a biblical writing. It is definitely not a biblical writing. It is a new genre, and as I said time and again, it's an unicorn. We don't have another book like it, or not even similar to it. There is no book like Sefer Yetzirah now. Okay, let me spend the rest of this time on Sefer Habakkuk. Sefer Habakkuk was written in the 12th century. That one we know very well because of a very simple criteria. It had words that could not have been in the Hebrew language before Abraham Bar Chiya wrote in the end of the 11th century and the beginning of the 12th century at Milot HaHegayon or Megillat HaMegaleh. We have the best thing in order to ascertain a time of a book is philology. Philology is study of words where you can say a word with a date. Like we can say that a space shuttle is not a word that was available before the 20th century. So any text that would mention a space shuttle could not precede the 20th century. In such ways, there are words and sentences in the book Bahir which could not precede certain midrashim and certain texts known to us from later centuries. However, saying that, we don't know enough where it has been written. We know where it has been first found. It has been first found as a text, found meaning that somebody is commenting on it, somebody is interpreting, somebody is mentioning it. It was first found in Provence, in France, around the city of Narbonne. Narbonne was the center of the yeshivot in 12th century France, where Rabbi Abraham ben David was the leader. His son, Rabbi Yitzchak Kadinahor, was the first Kabbalist. His nephew, Asher ben David, was a leading Kabbalist. The whole thing, the whole new venture of Kabbalah, is the end of the 12th century. It's happening where the Sefer HaBahir is first found and new body of literature is first introduced. This new body is called philosophy. I want you to know, to make note of that point. At the 12th century, for the first time, philosophical books have been translated by Yehuda ibn Tibbon, Shmuel ibn Tibbon, and Moshe ibn Tibbon. Those are the Tibbonim, the great translators from Arabic to Hebrew. According to the request of Rabbi Abraham ben David, the head of the yeshiva in Narbonne. The same Abraham ben David, it was known in the circles of the yeshivot as the Raivad, but Raivad is Rabbi Abraham ben David. Rabbi Abraham ben David of Narbonne, the author of Hasagot al Rambam, this Rabbi Abraham ben David ordered the translation of philosophical books from Arabic into Hebrew. It was on account of him that HaKuzari, Chovot HaLevavot, Seadia Gaon, which were all authored in Arabic, were translated into Hebrew and offered the opportunity to become acquainted with the Neoplatonic philosophical system of thought, with the outgrowth of the Spanish Muslim Hebrew literature that was not available before the 12th century because it was only in Arabic. So Latin Europe, France, didn't know about it. It's the very same time, it's all happening in the same time. The unknown text known as Sefer HaBahir is introduced in those circles. The philosophical literature translated from Spanish to Hebrew according to the commission of the Rabbi Abraham ben David in the yeshiva. And a new thing, a fresh thing, which is called Kabbalah, is being authored by the son of Rabbi Abraham ben David, Rabbi Yitzchak Kadinahor. The word Kadinahor means iver, means blind. Rabbi Yitzchak, the founder of Kabbalah, was blind. He was apparently born blind. And he had extraordinary attention to language and to sound, and naturally people who are disabled to see have greater attention to sound and voice. This Rabbi Yitzchak ben David, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Nahor ben Avraham ben David, is the first person that we call a mekubal, a kabbalist, a person who creates a new text, calling it Kabbalah. Now it's interesting, this word, Kabbalah means tradition. He does not introduce it as a new thing, he introduces it as a tradition that was requested. It might be true, it might be partially true. It certainly is affected by Sefer Yetzirah. Rabbi Yitzchak ben Nahor's first writing known to us is the commentary on Sefer Yetzirah. He is commentating about the text that I just now read, Sefer Yetzirah. Kabbalah starts where Sefer Yetzirah is being appropriated here in Korban in the 12th century, the end of the 12th century, where Sefer Yetzirah is appropriated and newly nourished by Sefer Abishur. So Kabbalah is like a delta where we have three things. We have Sefer Abahir, Sefer Yetzirah, and Tikrut HaNechalot, and at the very same time, we have the new philosophical Neoplatonic text in the very same place and vicinity. It's a very rich intellectual text. That's the place where Halakha is being taught, where Kabbalah is being taught, where the Tosfot are being part of the curriculum. It's a very thriving intellectual text. What does the book Bahir add? They have no idea where it comes from. They call it Midrash Yerushalmi. They think it's a Midrash, Sefer Bahir. It's book Bahir. I'm talking about that one. This book Bahir introduces itself as a Midrash. Why? Because it starts. So said Rabbi Hanina ben Akaneh, so said Rabbi Nachunya ben Akaneh, so said Rabbi Eliezer. It introduced itself as a Halakhic literature introduced itself as a scribe to Tanaim. The people who wrote Sefer Bahir did not care to introduce themselves by their own name. They chose pseudo-epigrapha. It definitely hasn't been written by Rabbi Nachunya ben Akana or by Rabbi Eliezer or by other sages, or sages which are mentioned there, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Hala, all kinds of sages are mentioned. They are all pseudo-epigraphically suggested. They are anonymous. The real writers are anonymous. When this text is first introduced in 12th century Korban, we are told that it is called in two names. Midrash Yerushalmi or Midrash Rabbi Nachumia ben Akane. It suggests that it comes from the East. It comes either from the land of Israel or from Babylon. It comes from the East. There are a couple of things in the book which suggest that it might have some Eastern origin, because they are talking on palms, they are talking on gmalim, on camels. There are few things that possibly only can suggest that, yet it could be entirely literary debate. We don't know. What we do know, that again, this is an unicum, that's a book that doesn't have one night. What does it tell us? It tells us that the deity, again, it is talking, it is interested about three things. It's interested about language in the way that Sefer Yetzirah is interested, in the nature of letters. What are the double letters? What are the simple letters? What is the grammatical division of the language? Very much interested in language. It's interested in a new thing never before introduced. It's interested in what we call dualism. It divides the world between good side and bad side in a new way. It's not like previous ways. It's not like biblical notions. It's not like midrashic notions. It has a new face to it. But maybe most important, it divides the deity into two sections, into emanator and emanated. Ma'atzil v'ne'etzalim. Ma'atzil, that's emanator, a divine entity which emanates the ten spheres, or the ten attributes, or the ten realms. But when this division is being suggested, we have two further divisions. All the whole entire invisible world is divided to infinite invisible God on one side and partially visual emanation. animated being on the other side. We have now new perception of the divinity. Now we have emanator and emanated or emanated, and we can call it, for making it easier, and so the spirit, or the infinite and the spheres, or the king and the daughter of the king. All of them are synonyms. The king is the invisible God, the daughter is the Shekhinah, the daughter is the Sphirot. We have numerous metaphors, symbols, drawings, ideas, but the common denominator to it all, that they are all relating only to two focuses. All the numerous metaphors and symbols in Sefer HaBahir are either referring in a visual metaphor to the emanate head, or in audible metaphors to the emanate term. So we have three things. We have distinction between infinite emanating and divine entity, which is described as king, as invisible king, as eternal king, and we have a new dimension of emanated world. This emanated world is called Eser Midot, Eser Sfirot, Eser Atziluyot, according to Sefer Yetzirah, 10 different ranks of this. But the new thing about Sefer HaBahir is that every human action is corresponding to one of those 10 attributes, to one of those 10 ranks, to one of those 10 options. And those 10 things are affected by human action, and affecting human action. That has never been said before. We didn't hear before about common relations between human action and divine 10 attributes, or divine 10 attributes and human action. In Sefer HaBahir, it starts to take form. So we have the emanator and the emanated. We have the audible symbols of the emanator and the visual symbols of those who are emanated. And these parts, the emanated, which are called Sfirot, attributes, and so on, we have the relations with the human, the mutual relations, and we have the new things, entirely the new symbols that Sefer HaBahir has contributed to Kabbalah, the idea of the tree of souls and the idea of the tree of spirit. The symbol of tree, which is of course relating to Et Chaim and the ancient tree of life and so on, now it is Et HaSfirot, Ilan HaSfirot, Ilan HaAtzilut, the very symbol of tree of spirit, tree of emanation, tree of attributes on one side, and Ilan HaNeshamot, the tree of the human soul. Now that's the first place where human souls are part of the invisible heavenly world. It's entirely new textual life. It's entirely new way of thinking. It is introducing a world with numerous new ideas. We haven't heard before on the sharp dualism in the book Bahir. We haven't heard before on the tree of spirit, on the tree of life, on the tree of soul. We don't know where it is all coming from. It could come from Midrashic expositions. It could come from unknown mystical eruptions. It could come from exegetical words, but when it came, it was immediately perceived as a holy book representing sacred mystical way of thinking. So we have now two texts. We have the text of Sefer HaBahir, we have the text of Sefer Yetzirah, which are both new but corresponding one to the other. We have the old Sifrut HaHeichalot, and all of them, with no exception, is introduced with names of saints. Supposedly, when those new ideas are introduced, they are ascribed to the saints. So one cannot say that they are wrong. One cannot say it's illegitimate. One cannot say it's heretic. It's considered to be a Mishnah or Midrash. The same with Sefer Yetzirah, the same with Sefer HaBahir. We may want to ask, Did the people in the medieval ages were afraid to introduce new ideas, Did they feel that way? I want to read to you one verse, and by that we conclude. By the great Jewish French historian Max Bloch, who wrote on the medieval period. He said so. היציבות של מערכת המציאות נתמכת בכך שהיא מוצגת כקיימת במתכונתה הנראית לעין מימים ימימה. המנטליות של בני הימים ההם תאבה מהפכות ותמורות בסדר הקיים, ועל כן נאלצה להציג את המתחדש בלבוש האנשכיות. אל תנקל. The stability of the perception of reality was supported by being presented as existing as it is from ever and ever. The mentality of the people of the medieval ages detested revolution, detested original inventions in the existential order. Because of this, everything that has been innovated has to be presented as a continuity. Max Bloch is not talking here on Jewish writing, but Max Bloch, the French Jewish historian who invented the perception of the annals, the modern history, who was assassinated by the Nazis, but unfortunately he was a very great historian, the best one who described the mentality of the medieval ages, asserts here something of great importance that we should take into consideration when we try to understand why they ascribe all their new ideas to all their authorities. Originality was not a value. It was causing fear. Change was not a value. Continuity was a value. Tradition was a value. The authority of the elders was a value. So when you had a new idea, when you had a new insight, you had to introduce it under the guise of earlier authority. That was the common perception of the time, and presumably that's the reason that our forefathers who wrote those new ideas introduced them as continuation of the sages of old. We would find the very same phenomenon in the early Kabbalah and by the book of the Zohar. It also would be ascribed to the Tanah of Shimon Bar Yochai. We should see it as a part of a world perception which afraid from innovation and which likes continuity, and under this continuity introducing new ideas.